As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United, and we are back after the international break, and my goodness, again, we've got so much to talk about with Manchester United despite a ball not being kicked. We'll get into all the situation with the potential takeover, if we're even allowed to still call it that, I'm not sure, but we'll get into the details on that. We'll preview the game against Sheffield United this weekend as well. Manchester United's women are out of the Champions League. In a little bit of controversy, so we'll reflect on that, and we'll also talk about the Reds away on international duty. But first of all, Laurie Whitwell and Andy Mitten are with us. We need to say a huge thank you to everyone who came out to our shows in Belfast and Dublin this week. It was absolutely incredible, Laurie, wasn't it?
Yeah, a couple of wild atmospheres, particularly the one in Dublin when...
I've never been heckled so much.
It was like heckled, but it was also... They just were really eager to get involved. But I did... I think that Carl absolutely nailed it when he just shouted out, "One heckle at a time, please."
Carl's not even back yet, is he? He's still
He's loving
there
it so much he stayed over there, yeah.
I was going to say, he had to miss his girlfriend's birthday to do the live show in Dublin, and he's making it up to her as we speak, I think. But Andy, absolutely fantastic. I've never had so many pints of Guinness and still expected to be able to perform on a stage. Not everyone did that though, did they?
It was fantastic. You're loading me with questions here like you did on the stage in Dublin. I struggled with my Guinness in Dublin. I'll tell you why, I was exhausted. I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday and it's tiring. I'm not 21 anymore, I'm 22. And adrenaline carries you through. I had a good few pints of Guinness in Belfast, got to Dublin, and I just slumped. I was just exhausted. And we did the show, and I had to leave very, very quickly at the end of the show. We can say this.
I was like, we're doing a little pitch, are we? And no, he's gone. He's off.
He's gone.
So he needed to sort himself
out. I had this
out.
Beautiful looking pint of Guinness in front of me on the stage, and I couldn't touch it because I was about to vomit. Three times I felt like I was going to vomit, right? And by the end of it, I knew that Laurie's last story, which is a belter, I'm thinking, right, we're down to the last 2 minutes of this. We're down to the last 90 seconds of this. We're down to the last minute. There's about 45 seconds of this to go. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I ran off. I ran straight towards the toilet, opened the door, and was doing a mid-air vomit. And, wow. I mean... I'm being honest.
This is the first time we've heard
well,
this.
Well, it's the truth.
He couldn't speak after the show. That's why it's the first time we've heard it.
You've got a 10K coming up, though, haven't you, Andy? Was that a bit of training for it? It's a bit of sprint training.
I've got a 10K on Sunday. There were witnesses to my projectile vomiting, and I cleaned myself up quickly in the area around the toilet and went back outside and spoke to some of the Reds who turned up in Dublin. And I loved a couple of days there. It was... The pods were great, and I think... You get something in real life when you're speaking to people, the humour. You know, I can look at like your socks, for example, which I can't naturally do when we're speaking on the podcast. And yeah, thanks to everyone for coming to Belfast and to Dublin. I'd love it if we can go back again and maybe go to some other cities in Ireland too.
Can I just quickly explain what Andy did with the Guinness in the day in Dublin. You know, he obviously smashed it in Belfast and done it properly, but he ordered half a pint of Guinness in Dublin for lunch, and then he drank half of it, so he didn't even make his full way through. So we're obviously now calling that, you know, the Jim Ratcliffe, 25%.
You've teed it up very nicely, Laurie. Let's get into it then. There's a meeting taking place, we understand, later today. We're recording just after 9 a.m. on Thursday morning, when Manchester United's board members will meet to vote on a proposal from Sir Jim Ratcliffe's Ineos Group to purchase 25% of Manchester United. That's the situation as we understand it at the moment. How do you see this progressing, Andy?
I don't think the progress will be quite as quick as some people seem to think it is. Certainly in the media, I've had editors saying the game against Sheffield United will be Sir Jim Ratcliffe's first game in charge. I'm like, what? Hold your horses. I think this has been protracted throughout, and it absolutely seems like we're closer to some kind of resolution, one which is far from ideal, by the way. I wouldn't be stunned if we were still talking about this in weeks and even months. I know that Richard Arnold, in his staff meeting, which was quite recent, said these things can take time. So we might see some progress, but I cannot say that this time tomorrow, Sir Jim Ratcliffe stroke Ineos will hold 25% of my pint of Guinness.
Laurie, in terms of the meeting today, obviously, as we're recording, it's not taking place. By the time this reaches people's ears, it may well have done. But what are we expecting to happen?
Well, we're expecting a board meeting to take place. People close to United say that it's been long in the diary, which is, you know, fair enough. You've got to take that at face value. I'm always a little bit sceptical of stuff like that. You know, you can kind of say that it's been in the diary after the event, after it's all been sort of put together. But listen,
after it's in the diary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But clearly, this vote on Sir Jim Ratcliffe's bid is something that's been talked about, whether they'll actually get to it at this point, because the devil is in the detail in terms of there's so many questions, aren't there? In how, you know, does he buy the Class B and Class A shares? That's what we think, to make it appealing to the investors over at the New York Stock Exchange. How does he get that sporting control? That's the big crucial element to it all. He doesn't want to go in there and buy a load of shares of United for £1.3 billion is what we're expecting, and then not have any say over the running of the club. What we're told is that the Glazers are open to that because they feel that, yeah, okay, they accept the football side of things hasn't been great under their stewardship, certainly since Sir Alex Ferguson's gone. So does that actually allow them to get more value out of the club if they give it to somebody who they think or he thinks can do a better job of the football side of things? But it strikes as a curious dynamic, that, doesn't it? How that gets resolved in a contractual, in a legally binding way is going to be fascinating. It did feel like last weekend at the point that Sheikh Jassim pulled out, because that was kind of the starting gun on all this. You know, that they took the initiative, the Qataris, to say we're out here, and there has been so much claim, counterclaim. You know, there's been reasons why people have put stuff in the public domain that might not be totally transparent to begin with. You know, there's been negotiations and how do you get, you know, somebody to accept your bid, you know, so you kind of have to take a skeptical view of a lot of what's been said in this whole process, which is nearly a year long. You know, it was November, wasn't it, when they announced the strategic review with those keywords that it could be a full sale, but actually we're getting to this point of maybe it's a piece of the pie for Jim Ratcliffe first, and then he can perhaps expand it into a majority overall. Everyone you speak to that knows Sir Jim Ratcliffe's, you know, past business dealings, he wants control of what he owns. You know, he wants to have full ownership as well, so that you don't have to have these investor calls where people can ask you questions. You don't have to necessarily show your full accounts every single year and every single quarter. So it did feel like this was going to be, actually, maybe this has all been agreed already, and that's why Sheikh Jassim's pulled out. He realises the writing's on the wall. But as Andy sort of touched on, as the days have gone on, it's become clearer that there's still, you know, a fair bit to sort out.
Nothing's been agreed. I think that's the one of the points here. And there's been twice where Ineos have felt they are close to something, and that hasn't happened. And I've said a couple of times on this podcast, I can remember clearly saying it in March, that I would expect something to happen in the next couple of weeks, and never really happened. So I think that Ratcliffe feels, well, I know, not that they're allowed to talk because they've signed NDAs, but that this is the only deal that they can do. It's this or the status quo, with the Glazers staying in charge. And for whatever reason, the Qatar bid, they've decided to pull out. And some people like that, and some people dislike that. I've got concerns with both. And if it looks like it's going to be the Ratcliffe deal, I've got concerns because the Glazers are still there. I don't think they've been good for Manchester United. I don't just suddenly think that giving Ineos stroke Ratcliffe control of the sporting side is going to mean Manchester United are going to start winning games all the time. They've got a pretty patchy record in sport, even though they put a lot of money into it. I've been to Nice. I've seen their blueprint, which is pretty impressive. The stadium, the city, everything about it, apart from the results. Although this season, they are doing much better. But some of their transfer signings have been worse than Manchester United's in recent years. Let's not beat about the bush here. As Laurie said, Jim Ratcliffe wants full control of Manchester United. He is a man who likes a deal. He is a man who can play the long game. He cannot force the Glazers to do a deal. So what does he do? Does he walk away, or does he try and do it, not through a back doorway because he's paying a lot of money, but he wants to be in a position to change Manchester United for the better, not for the worse. If he's doing it for the worse, what's in it for him? He's 70 years old. Is he going to piss off everybody in the city where he grew up? He's not getting any younger. He's going to want a happy ending to all of this, just like Manchester United fans. He's using his own money. And there will be extra to go into the infrastructure. That's my firm understanding of it. So what's the infrastructure? Old Trafford, chiefly. I know some money's been spent on Carrington. Quite interesting. I've seen the new women's and academy block at Carrington. It is a decent facility. I go to lots of training grounds around the world. I posted some pictures of that yesterday on Twitter, and I know Twitter's a complete mess. The negative reaction to it is that, no, I'm sorry, it's a decent facility. And I think sometimes people get overblown with Old Trafford is decrepit. It's not, it's still a very good stadium, but it needs significant redevelopment, and if not, a new stadium altogether. And that's a separate issue from that. And Ratcliffe is well aware of these issues and of how important they are to fans. He's not going to have a majority of the shares, but he will have power. He wants a significant influence. He's putting money in, and he wants this to be a path to change. So let's see what that leads to. If you would have said this to me 12 months ago, I would have been more encouraged by that than not. But since then, we've had the Qataris, which turned a lot of heads, and United fans were completely divided as whether Qatar would be a good thing for the club or not. And now we've got Ratcliffe. So let's see what happens.
It's interesting, actually, from the shows that we did, and it's obviously only the people who came to the shows, but from the people in both Belfast and Dublin, it was very mixed about who was, you know, wanting Sir Jim Ratcliffe to take over, who was wanting Sheikh Jassim-led investment. It was just completely split. There was no unanimous decision either way, really, on it. And I think that is reflective of the wider fan base as well, both online and at games. There's differences to that in terms of, you know, which is weighted in what direction. It feels like people online were more in favour of Qatar, and people perhaps in person or behind paywalls, like Andy's spoken about, Athletic subscribers, for instance, felt that Jim Ratcliffe's interest was more appealing. It's a very divisive issue, this, Laurie, and already we've had statements from different fans groups. We've had statements from even Gary Neville asking very serious questions, and questions that are going to need to be clarified before fans know what to think about this.
Absolutely, yeah. And even people that have, you know, long been associated with Manchester United as a kind of community asset and a local club for the people of the area were attracted by the Qatari takeover, because they saw that as the only way that United were going to get a stadium really fit for purpose, training ground, you know, transfers that they could really compete with Manchester City. My personal instinct was always to kind of step back from that, just because I think having, and I know, you know, it was a Sheikh Jassim-led bid and, you know, what have you, but I kind of feel like that element of potential state ownership would change United forever. You know, you could never put the genie back in the bottle. And I think that would change things for me as United, someone who grew up as a United fan and what the club means, you know, to the wider world. And you know, that's what United have at the moment. You know, City are winning all these titles, and you can say, well, okay, it's because of the takeover, and it's because you are funded by a nation state. You know, I know that's very simplistic. You know, it's because they've got good people in good positions as well, and they have, you know, real talent in there. But I think that does the Qataris, if it had been that way, and obviously you can't write them off. You know, as I said earlier, you know, there's been different elements of this where it's looked like they were going to get the club, and you know, you don't know exactly the reasons for things coming out publicly, but it does feel that at the moment, you know, that would be a remote possibility, but I would always just have that door slightly ajar. But I think that the Ratcliffe bid, as Andy sort of touched on, allows a potential end point where you've got a guy who did grow up as a United fan, who's clearly been very successful in business, and you can debate the merits of those, the businesses that he's grown, but that he's got the wealth to do it. Yeah, it's not going to be spending money with absolute, you know, free limits, but I think he would have care to the job, you know, he and the people that he appoints. You know, and it's not been a smooth sailing ride at Nice or any, you know, of his sporting institutions, to be fair, but I think the way that they've gone about it is quite data driven and quite, you know, it's involved. You know, he was there in person at Old Trafford and Carrington on these tours. You know, he clearly cares, and that's something you can't say for the Glazers, so surely that's a better possibility than having them just as complete owners. You know, surely having Sir Jim Ratcliffe in some way involved would generate that kind of thing that we've spoken about with Brighton, where you know, you've got an owner that cares and an owner that, you know, sets standards and you know, is involved. You know, I mean, Andy touched on the improvements at Carrington for the women's team, and I agree. I think it's a perfectly good building for, you know, women and academy. It's been, you know, developed over the summer, you know, quite quickly now that they're actually giving it the green light. I suppose it always just feels though under the Glazers that it's piecemeal and it's kind of only reactive because of pressure, because, you know, Casey Stoney perhaps walked out as women's manager and said the facilities weren't good enough, and then it's kind of gone, okay, we need to react to this. So I wonder if Sir Jim Ratcliffe coming in would then at least give that kind of some forward momentum. He wants sporting control straight away, so that does, you know, bring uncertainty to some people that are already in positions. You know, you look at football director John Murta, who appointed by Ed Woodward in the first instance, and Richard Arnold as the chief executive. Ratcliffe clearly has, you know, ideas on how he would structure the sporting side of things, and I think we've touched on in pieces in The Athletic this week some of the names. Paul Mitchell's been one that's been mentioned to me, who he left Monaco in the summer after having a good experience there. He's obviously worked in England before, and as Andy said, I'm not saying that this is major wave a magic wand and it's all better at United. It's not that simple. It's a complex beast. There's lots of things that can go wrong, even if you have the absolute best people involved. But that's just something that we're hearing, that, you know, Sir Jim Ratcliffe feels that, you know, United on the sporting side could be better.
Just quickly, Laurie, as well, before we wrap this up, how's this board meeting going to work? Because we're across time zones, we're across countries. What's it going to look like?
Yeah, I think it's going to be remote. Dial in, you know, the power of Zoom or any of your video conference call facilities. It might actually be Teams that they use at United. Anyway, yeah, so
you need to find out this sort of detail.
This is the
detail,
kind of detail, the granular detail that we pride ourselves on at The Athletic. I mean, you've got, you know, the Glazers over in America, Tampa or Washington. You've got United staff over in Manchester. So the people that will be dialing in, there's three independent directors. There's the chief executive, Richard Arnold. There's the chief legal counsel, Patrick Stewart, and the chief financial officer, Cliff Beatty. And then there's the six Glazer siblings. Now, you know, it kind of does seem a bit obtuse that you'd say, well, it needs to go to a vote. But the Glazers own, the voting power that they have in the Class B shares doesn't work in this scenario. This is a board vote. So you've got, you know, six Glazer siblings, six non-Glazer siblings. And if there's a tie in terms of what they think, then it goes to the co-chairs, who are Joel Glazer and Avram Glazer. So the Glazers ultimately have control, yeah? Like, if they're all agreeing on this, that, that it gets passed. Is it an issue, though, if the board is split and something gets out that, you know, there wasn't a unanimous vote? Because that's what we're told happened previously with a former sort of Ratcliffe offer that was discussed at board level. But anyway, so it, so if it goes to a vote today or at any point, that's how it works, basically, where you've got, you know, Joel and Avram ultimately, if they want something to happen and they've got their siblings on board, then it will happen. I guess the one question is, what happens if Joel and Avram disagree?
Andy, the people in Manchester on this call, are they going to have to go into work for this? Or are they going to be in the back bedrooms in their offices? It's bizarre, isn't it? We're doing this now, but you sort of think at that level that it'd be different, but I guess it's not.
Well, there is a boardroom at Old Trafford, Ian. There's also one in London as well.
True.
I've been in both of them for various reasons to do interviews. I remember interviewing David Gill in the one at Old Trafford, and most recently got a call 24 hours before this Brazilian lad called Casimiro signed, saying, will you come and interview him? Because his English wasn't like perfect Mancunian accent, so obviously I had to come in and speak to him in Spanish. So went to Old Trafford on a day of massive protest before the Liverpool game at the start of last season, and waited in the boardroom, which overlooks the forecourt at Old Trafford. It's high up in the East Stand, and do you want me to describe it? Well, it's got a nice big table and lots of chairs around it. And then, I'm not sure it was the table at Factory Records, which bankrupted the company, but it was a very nice boardroom. And Casimiro walks in. Hey, son, nice to see you, mate. Welcome to Manchester, I said in an accent. He went, eh, dad.
Okay, well, I'm sure this won't be the last time that we talk about, well, it might be the last time we talk about the Manchester United boardroom table, but it won't be the last time we talk about this takeover situation. There's been lots of great writing on The Athletic about this already. There'll be more, I'm sure, as these meetings take place. So remember, if you want to read that and you're not a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/ManUnitedPod. There's an offer on at the moment as well. £1 a month or $1 a month for the first 12 months. So sign up.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, I mentioned at the top that no balls had been kicked for Manchester United over this international break, but plenty of Manchester United players have kicked balls, and one player has been kicked by San Marino players. Rasmus Højlund has been complaining on Instagram about his treatment in their game against the Minnow Nation, as they always seem to be referred to. Laurie, what's happened with this?
Quite tasty treatment, I think he got, really. He scored a good goal, and Denmark kind of toiled, didn't they, to a 2-1 win. So I don't know if that's kind of fueled the feeling around him making this public. But yeah, Cup came out on Instagram and basically said he and you know, professional footballers, I suppose, work every day to be the best version of themselves. And he called the behaviour by the San Marino players unacceptable. And then he'd also done like a video video of himself getting kneed in the back by Alessandro Tosi, I want to say. Look at that, Alessandro Tosi.
I'm glad you got the second name there right, mate. You could have easily slipped up there.
Wasn't what Hoyland was calling him. Yeah.
I mean, I am watching the clip and he's nowhere near the ball. He has just kneed him in the back, which obviously, you know, he had that back issue when he joined United. So I suppose maybe that's what has really caused a bit of acute anger from Hoyland, that actually maybe that, you know, it was something that has been targeted. Tosi, he's not tossed off Hoyland's complaints. He's responded. He says that basically this, you know, he wouldn't have survived as a player 20 years ago, and this is just part of the game. You know, it's a contact sport, and deal with it basically. But I don't know. It does feel like, I don't know. It looked like San Marino went a bit too far, and I can see why Haaland is kind of giving them some back. And again, it kind of means to me the guy's got personality. The guy is not going to just shirk away from having players kind of boot him. I don't think it's whiny, because I mean that's kind of what the San Marino players are getting at. You know, he's whining, he's complaining. But actually, you know, if he feels a certain way, you know, come out and say it.
You can look at it that way, or you can just say, you're Manchester United centre forward, Andy. You're gonna have to put up with stuff like this, aren't you? Now,
yeah, but if he's being targeted cynically, he's allowed to speak out for himself, because if someone tackles him and he breaks a leg or an ankle, then that's dangerous. I know San Marino, tiny nation that they are absolutely desperate for a win, but they don't need to push it that far. And I quite like Hoyland's attitude. I think he's got a good buzz around him when you see him on the field. He's a confident young man, and too many Manchester United players seem to struggle with the pressure of playing for Manchester United. And in my opinion, from what I've seen so far and heard about him, he doesn't. He's taking it in his stride, which when you consider how young he is and how he's come through pretty small clubs, fair play to him.
It seemed like it was a good experience for Manchester United's England players as well, Laurie. Harry Maguire started in the win over Italy, which qualified England for the Euros. Marcus Rashford scored a brilliant goal as well. That link up with Jude Bellingham that we should have been seeing at Old Trafford if things might have been different. Hopefully that kicks him into gear as well in club form for United. Bruno Fernandes, another one who continues to impress at international level. He needs to bring that back to Manchester as well.
Yeah, Rashford was a fun one, wasn't it? Because we were in Dublin and we were like, we need to keep sort of check on, you know, how United players are doing. And then it was at the interval, wasn't it, where we could kind of all gathered around your phone, I think it was, and checked out the goal.
Well, I went out for part two and went, yeah, Marcus Rashford scored for England. I guess that's a good thing. Yeah.
No one cared, did they? No. Yeah, quite the opposite. But I think what it did just remind people is that if you give Rashford the ball in space, he's attacking at pace, he can cut in and finish really smartly. He had a clarity of thought, didn't he, which is what we've discussed previously, where he obviously was in two minds really about what he was going to do with that chance when he was through on goal, and he squares to Bruno and it's too soft. And so that was really good to see, that he kind of had one thought in mind and just go straight at it. And obviously credit to Bellingham for being able to break the line and then give him the ball in a good bit of space. So yeah, I guess that's a Just something to remind people, you know, that's a way to goal for United.
Lots of international teams were playing. Did you see those Slovenia fans in our hotel in Belfast when we left on Tuesday morning? They were about to play Northern Ireland at Windsor Park. I was going to pull them over and try and talk about stadiums in Slovenia, but got dragged away myself. We did go past Windsor Park. Very disappointing for Northern Ireland. I know that international football was a main reason why Johnny Evans didn't want to retire in the summer. He wanted to carry on playing for Northern Ireland. They're not going to be going to the Euros, which is a bit of a disappointment for them, because the last reaching the finals in 2016 was a huge deal for them. And other countries have played as well. Portugal have won every single game in qualifying, so that's a record for them. So Diogo Dalot, Bruno Fernandes, obviously very important players for Portugal now. And the fact that they're winning, as Cristiano Ronaldo, while he's still very important, he's not getting any younger. So
he's still breaking
Portugal
records,
though,
isn't he? Not that we're interested anymore, but yeah.
No, we're not. But, you know, credit that he's doing it, even at international level, that he's continuing to add on that huge number of appearances for his country. Surprise winners in 2016. Would be very surprised if they won it in Germany next year. But really good week for the Portuguese lads.
So a positive experience then, certainly for Bruno Fernandes and Diogo Dalo, but not at all for Victor Lindelof. Absolutely tragic situation around their game against Belgium, Andy.
It was terrible. Two Swedish football fans, one in his 60s, one in his 70s, fatally shot. Taxi driver wounded. It was a shocking story, and Victor Lindelof and his partner spoke out about it as well. It's incredibly sad that people go and watch a football game and get killed. I can't even believe that I'm saying it like I am. So there's a lot of bad news around at the moment, and that was more bad news this week from Brussels.
There's been some news from Morocco that Amrabat may have picked up another injury or still been suffering from the back problem that meant that he sort of delayed his start to life at Manchester United as well. He missed their game against Liberia. But there has been some good news on the injury front over this international break, Laurie, from a behind-closed-doors friendly, we understand.
Kobbie Mainoo, who has been out since he had that unfortunate collision over in America, in Houston against Real Madrid. He played in a friendly at Carrington against Barnsley. So Barnsley sent a pretty decent team, we're told, and it was a team from United's point of view, primarily of, you know, kids. Kobbie Mainoo still is a kid, but you kind of have that idea that he's a first team footballer, which he is, and I think he's somebody that Erik ten Hag would have really liked to have available to him for these first few games, and who knows, maybe the pitch could have looked a little bit different. Not to put too much pressure on the kid, but he's obviously looked a good player.
We'd be top of the league if he didn't get injured, I think, don't you?
Oh, champions incoming. But apparently he was really sharp against Barnsley. United won 3-0, and yeah, Donny van der Beek played, Anthony played again, so obviously he's, you know, working his way back to full fitness after his time out, and Tom Heaton played as well in goal. So, and it was, I think Travis Binion was the manager for the game, which I think might have been a kind of a conscious choice by United, because Travis had managed the United under-21s against Bolton in the EFL Trophy, and they'd lost 8-1, which was, you know, it's a bad result, that. So I think this was an opportunity for him to, just have a team again and just get back into the groove of things.
I spoke to Travis the week before last when he oversaw the 19s in the 3-0 win against Galatasaray. So Isra Manu manages so many teams. He's good. I like his pitch side demeanour. He's very vocal to his players. He buys into the player development as a person and not just a player as well. So, but yeah, I think Laurie's right about that. And he was also in charge when United played against Wrexham in San Diego, and he spoke to some of us after the game over there in front of 32,000 or whatever it was. Not that I look out for attendances. So yeah, I think he's doing a decent job, and a difficult job, because quite often he has to field very young teams because players are sent out on loan, etc. So good that they're playing behind closed doors games. Some players clearly need minutes, especially in international breaks if they're no longer internationals anymore. So good.
Yeah, OK then. Before we move it on to preview the match against Sheffield United for the men's team this weekend, we need to reflect on the women being knocked out of the Champions League at the second round stage against PSG, which is a hugely disappointing result for the club, considering it would have meant progressing through to the group stage in the competition. Of course, it was Manchester United's first ever Champions League tie for the women's team. They lost 3-1 away at PSG after drawing the first leg 1-1. And it's opened up a bit of a debate about the format of the tournament, Andy, hasn't it?
I watched the game. I wasn't there, unlike a decent United following who were there. Manchester United got to this stage because they didn't win the title last year, so it's not that dissimilar to the men's, where you're put into a position but you're not put into the group stage. Although if you'd finished second in the Premier League, you would go straight into the group stage of the Champions League.
It is different, isn't it? Because, you know, if you finish second or third in the Premier League, you're straight into the group stage, whereas in the women's version, you're not. And it's unseeded in the first and second round as well. So not just Manchester United have gone out, but Arsenal and Wolfsburg, who were semi-finalists last year, played in front of something like 60,000 fans at the Emirates Stadium at that stage last year as well. Juventus, one of the most high-profile women's teams in Italy, are out as well.
I don't think any of them teams going out at this stage helps the Champions League. There are a couple of factors. The group stage is much smaller than the men's. It's only 16 teams. England, who are top-seeded in the men's in terms of the coefficients, are not top-seeded in the women's game. So the most dominant teams have actually come from France, Lyon. That's why Paris finished second last year. But your point is right. Wolfsburg have been a majorly important team. I watched them play in front of 91,000 people at Barcelona last year. So when you're losing these big, big names, you're not really igniting interest, because if Manchester United would have got through to the group stage, that would have been a really big deal. And it was frustrating watching the game. Paris did deserve to win. United were much better in the second half. Some terrible decisions went against Manchester United. Leah Galton, to my eyes, scored a perfectly good goal. And I've watched it again and again. And I thought United were hard done by. And then a few other decisions as well. That said, two of the goals were pretty slack. PSG, within seconds of Manchester United's goal, went straight down the other end, and that really took the sting out of it. It was a big deal. It was at Parc des Princes. There was a big crowd there. What a shame that all that effort to get into a position to get into the Champions League is undone in one playoff game, because when it's the men's playoffs, it's normally like Olympiacos against pretty big teams. You'll get a PSV, even a Galatasaray this year. But it ain't Manchester United and Paris. And I'm not saying any of them have got a divine right to be in there, but I think that competition could be tweaked for the better.
Yeah, if you want to read more about the format argument in the Women's Champions League, Charlotte Harper's got the article on The Athletic. Right, well, we're only a couple of days away from Manchester United being back in Premier League action. And Laurie, they'll just pick up where they left off with that finish against Brentford, won't they?
What, like two goals in the first 5 minutes or something, yeah.
Scott McTominay breaking into the box, yeah, absolutely. Being set up by Harry Maguire. It's exactly how it's going to go, isn't it?
Does he start?
Big question. Interesting question.
Well, I suppose, you know, if you think of Casemiro having had that knock for Brazil and travelling, you know, to those games, is there a thought that actually, and he came off at half time, didn't he, against Brentford? So is there a way that you sort of look at that and go, actually, Sheffield United away as well, you know, you expected to have more of the ball, so perhaps you're able to put a player like McTominay in there to kind of get in amongst the, you know, in the box. I mean, it's Man City played there, didn't they, early in the season, and Sheffield United gave them a good game. And actually, it was only at the end when they'd equalised Sheffield United that City then thought, right, we actually need to get bodies in the box here. And Rodri took the initiative and basically scored the winner. And it was him, wasn't it, that scored. And so that kind of idea of, you know, just get more players up and get more players in the back. I don't know, maybe that's the thought for Ten Hag. But yeah, hopefully United can harness the momentum of that, you know, fabulous finish to the game against Brentford. I mean, yeah, as we touched on after the game straight away, just the noise was incredible. And I know the international break perhaps then comes at a bad time, but probably a moment to pause for everybody and just sort of then come back and renew their attempts to get United back up the table. I mean, they have to win, don't they, against Sheffield United? It's again, a not non-negotiable on that score. But it will be interesting to see what team Ten Hag puts out, because he made so many changes that second half against Brentford. Where does he now land, you know, with what his best team is?
I think Johnny Evans, the Belfast Barese, and Harry Maguire going back to his former club might be a little bit miffed if they're not playing, but clearly I wouldn't expect them to be the main two central defenders. Must win. You're totally right, Laurie. Sheffield United have not won a game so far this season. They've drawn one match. The goal scoring record is almost as bad as Manchester United's. They've conceded far more goals than the rest, 22 goals. So that's 10 more than Manchester United. It's pretty hard to concede that many goals.
They did concede 8 in one game, though.
Yeah, you know, I didn't like that. When I saw that, I just thought, my respect for Newcastle United is going down, not up, and that's probably more about the ownership. I've got a respect for Sheffield United as a proper football club. Although even then, as I'm saying that, I know they've had massive ownership issues themselves. Sheffield is a great city to go to watch Manchester United. We really miss Sheffield Wednesday.
It's a great city to go to. I spent 3 brilliant years there at university. Fantastic. Nothing to do with studying, by the way.
It's a top city. And it's very close to Manchester, and it's a big city. It's a football city. I'd love Sheffield Wednesday back up there. I like Sheffield United. Bramall Lane's a proper English football ground to go to.
Good away section as well.
Yeah, it's a top away section. It's really steep, and I'm not so sure about the 8 p.m. on a Saturday night kickoff. Not because I'm a rugby fan and it might clash with that, but because one of my mates said to me after Burnley, it took me until Tuesday to recover from that Saturday night out in Burnley. It is a must win. Copenhagen on Tuesday is a must win as well, and Manchester City following that absolutely is a must win.
What a week.
Do you know what you just reminded me there, Andy, in terms of the stadium? I was in the away section when Ronaldo had that miss, you know. It was absolute open goal. 3 yards. I think United still won the game, didn't they? 2-1. I think, did Evra do something in it? But yeah, just when you mentioned that, just flashed before my eyes, like, wow, that was probably the worst miss I've ever seen.
It's a really steep stand above the what was a formerly standing section. So I first went there in 1990, FA Cup sixth round. I had a standing ticket. The view was terrible. You had these big concrete bollards in front of you, but the seats are an absolute luxury. You mentioned that Man City game earlier on. I watched a bit of that. I thought, go on, you're telling me there's a chance here. Sheffield United, go on. And City did what City do. So I consciously a few weeks ago thought, I'm just going to completely ignore Manchester City. And since I've done that, they've lost both games. So this is a tactic that's working.
Yeah, they've lost 3 out of 4, City, haven't they? Hopefully they don't find form before the derby. Or even worse, find form in the derby, which would be particularly problematic. We didn't mention about McTominay either, Laurie, did we? Scotland have qualified for Euro 2004 and he's had as big a hand as anyone in doing that. And maybe he should be on set pieces as well after that free kick that's disallowed. He seems to be able to do everything at the minute.
Well, talking about goals that shouldn't be ruled out for minor nudges, I mean, I think UEFA seemed to change their mind on why that goal, the free kick. So it's like,
bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, it's from near the corner flag and McTominay. I mean, I didn't know. I don't think. Have you ever seen McTominay take a free kick? Not one to
not like
shoot
that,
for goal,
no.
Right? I mean, it was a great effort.
He did say that he'd been watching the Beckham documentary, yeah. But I didn't think it had like quite go that well.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
It's that osmosis.
Move it like McTominay. Yeah, and then obviously to get it ruled out, and it would have put them 1-0 up, and could it have changed the result? Ultimately, I know Spain won 2-0, but and that would have been a really nice moment for him, you know, just to capitalise a total. I mean, he obviously still celebrated it, and maybe he can take some pride in that, but it's frustrating that in this world of VAR, you kind of get these issues where goals that no one wants that ruled out. Not even the Spanish players want that ruled out, because what's the point? You just kill joys. But nevertheless, Scotland qualifying, hopefully that means that he's you know, comes back in with that kind of spiky personality that he's got. You know, clearly he's got the bit between his teeth at the moment.
I guess we're speculating a little bit, considering we don't know exactly who's going to be available for Erik ten Hag this weekend. But what Scott McTominay's goals did do, Andy, at the end of the Brentford game, they maybe eased some of the selection dilemmas that the manager had. I mean, you've mentioned Maguire and Evans maybe starting this game after their performance in that match. We talked about Casemiro going off at half-time and the finish to the match that McTominay had. Marcus Rashford's been brought off 3 games in a row early. There's question marks over Andre Onana in goal after yet another mistake against Brentford as well. It's going to be an interesting team sheet at Sheffield United, isn't it?
I wouldn't have any issue whatsoever with Scott Van Basten starting in that bear pit of Bramall Lane on Saturday night. I think he's done enough, and I think he might be suited to that type of game. It's going to be a very difficult game where Sheffield United are going to try and drag Manchester United down, try and defend, and you mention the different areas around the pitch where there's selection issues. As I speak now, I don't know who's available or who's not available.
No, there is that, yeah. Because like Reguilon, I think, was the closest to being back maybe, so that perhaps changes things a little bit.
Yeah, we did get a little nod on that a few weeks ago, but we weren't sure when he was going to be back. I mean, please get one left back back. That is the one real problem area for Manchester United is the left back position. And just to get closer to Erik ten Hag being able to be close to choosing his idealised 11, but I suspect that has also changed because of the poor form of some players.
I'm not sure he'll know what his idealised 11 is at the minute, Laurie, will he?
I mean, he probably has an idea in his mind if everyone's fit and actually
quite
full form. Yeah, I know, they're two huge ifs. Yeah, as Andy's touched on, I think the left-back thing, as long as he can get Amrabat into midfield, if Amrabat's fit, another if. Reguilon, we're hoping that Reguilon's going to be fit, I think. Luke Shaw still, you know, I think November you're looking at for his return, to be honest. So a little bit of hesitation on whether, you know, when he'll be back, really.
Goalkeeper? I don't think so.
I think he has to stick with Onana, doesn't he? He played, didn't he, against Senegal in a friendly during this international break. So that's another issue, you know, to kind of just have a thought on ahead of AFCON maybe later in the year, next year. Trying to think of the other ones. I mean, Garnacho, does he? I mean, I think Rashford doing what he did for England, as you touched on, if there's no international break, would he have taken that huge decision to take Rashford out of the starting lineup after having taken him off, you know, early in 3 games when United needed to do something in those games? I think maybe that's given him food for thought, because Garnacho has obviously come on and shown a spark. But then again, when Garnacho starts, does it actually follow through? Does he have the same level of performance? Does Antony come back into the starting lineup? I mean, that's the one where he was basically a guarantee on the right, wasn't he? And then he sort of had to shuffle around with Mason Mount and Bruno Fernandes at different moments. So, yeah, he's got lots of sort of debates, I suppose, over different positions. I think maybe Casemiro's the big one, you know, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't start Casemiro.
And he's the only one who has. He's the only outfield player who's started every single game so far this season. So that would be significant.
And I do think with the centre-backs, I mean, you said, you know, Maguire and Evans, you know, you'd be surprised, but I suppose it's just whether Rafa Varane's fit. I mean, maybe Lindelof, you know, you'd have a debate there as well, but, you know, Maguire and Evans actually sort of defensively did pretty well against Brentford. And, you know, Sheffield United, you're kind of thinking they're not going to have to defend. Yeah, they can kind of push up a bit and it's not going to be like they're chasing him behind too much. So, I don't know.
Burnley. It's like Burnley a few weeks ago on a Saturday night. Johnny Evans was man of the match. That assist for that goal and his own goal, which he got disallowed.
Look,
Johnny comes
record.
Alive on a Saturday night. He'll go there, he'll get the winner and he'll go out in Gatecrasher in Sheffield if it didn't close down 15 years ago.
Yeah, and it shut down in 2006. It burnt down, which probably shows you just how in touch you are with the youth culture in Northern England right about now. But that's it for Talk of the Devils. I hope you enjoyed that. It was good to be back. Thank you again to everyone who came to the show. Thank you to everyone who's listened today. Thank you to Andy. Thank you to Laurie. And we'll see you on the next one. Take care. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.